And yet, the fabric of the shirt didn't smell like it used to. The boy holding her wasn't quite the same size, the same shape, the same boy.
"I don't think I can do this," Josie whispered.
Immediately, Drew pulled away from her. His face was flushed, and he couldn't look Josie in the eye.
"I didn't mean it like that. You and Matt..."
His voice went flat.
"Well, I know you're still his."
Josie looked up at the sky. She nodded at him, as if that was what she had meant in the first place. It all began when the service station left a message on the answering machine. Peter had missed his car inspection appointment. Did he want to reschedule? Lewis had been alone in the house, retrieving that message. He had dialed the number before he even realized what he was doing, and thus it was no surprise to find himself actually keeping the rescheduled appointment. He got out of the car, handed his keys to the gas station attendant.
"You can wait right inside," the man said. "There's coffee."
Lewis poured himself a cup, putting in 3 sugars and lots of milk, the way Peter would have fixed it. He sat down, and instead of picking up a worn copy of Newsweek, he thumbed through PC Gamer.
1, he thought. 2, 3.
On cue, the gas station attendant came into the waiting room.
"Mr. Houghton," he said, "the car out there. It's not due for a state inspection until July."
"I know."
"But you made this appointment."
Lewis nodded.
"I don't have that particular car with me right now."
It was impounded somewhere. Along with Peter's books and computer and journals and God only knew what else. The attendant stared at him, the way you do when you realize the conversation you're having has veered from the rational.
"Sir," he said, "we can't inspect a car that's not here."
"No," Lewis said, "of course not."
He put the magazine back down on the coffee table, smoothed its wrinkled cover. Then he rubbed a hand over his forehead.
"It's just... my son made this appointment," he said. "I wanted to keep it on his behalf."
The attendant nodded, slowly backing away.
"Right. So, how about I just leave the car parked outside?"
"Just so you know," Lewis said softly, "he would have passed inspection."
Once, when Peter was young, Lacey had sent him to the same sleepaway camp that Joey had gone to and adored. It was somewhere across the river in Vermont, and campers water skied on Lake Fairley and took sailing lessons and did overnight canoe trips. Peter had called the first night, begging to be brought home. Although Lacey had been ready to start the car and drive to get him, Lewis had talked her out of it.
"If he doesn't stick this out," Lewis had said, "how will he ever know if he can?"
At the end of 2 weeks, when Lacey saw Peter again, there were changes in him. He was taller, and he put on weight. But there was also something different about his eyes— a light that had been burned to ash somehow. When Peter looked at her, he seemed guarded, as if he understood that she was no longer an ally. Now he was looking at her the same way, even as she smiled at him, pretending that there was no glare from the fluorescent light over his head, that she could reach out and touch him instead of staring at him from the other side of the red line that had been drawn on the jail floor.
"Do you know what I found in the attic yesterday? That dinosaur you used to love, the one that roared when you pulled its tail. I used to think you'd be carrying it down the aisle at your wedding."
Lacey broke off, realizing that there might never be a wedding for Peter, or any aisle outside of a prison walkway, for that matter.
"Well," she said, turning up the wattage on her smile, "I put it on your bed."
Peter stared at her.
"Okay."
"I think my favorite birthday party of yours was the dinosaur one, when we buried those plastic bones in the sandbox and you had to dig for them," Lacey said. "Remember?"
"I remember nobody showed up."
"Of course they did.
Five kids, maybe, whose moms had forced them to be there, Peter said.
God, I was 6 years old. Why are we even talking about this?
Because I don't know what else to say, Lacey thought. She looked around the visitation room. There were only a handful of inmates, and the devoted few who still believed in them, caught on opposite sides of that red stripe. In reality, Lacey realized, this dividing line between her and Peter had been there for years. If you kept your chin up, you might even be able to convince yourself there was nothing separating you. It was only when you tried to cross it, like now, that you understood how real a barrier it could be.
Peter, Lacey blurted out, I'm sorry I didn't pick you up at sleepaway camp that time.
He looked at her as if she was crazy.
Thanks for that, but I got over it about 100 years ago. I know, but I can still be sorry.
She was sorry about 1,000 things, suddenly. That she didn't pay more attention when Peter showed her some new programming skill. That she hadn't bought him another dog after Dozer died. That they didn't go back to the Caribbean last winter vacation because Lacey had wrongly assumed they had all the time in the world.
Sorry doesn't change anything.
It does for the person who's apologizing.
Peter groaned.
What the fuck is this? Chicken soup for the kid without a soul?
Lacey flinched.
You don't have to swear in order to...
Fuck! Peter sang.
Fuck, 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 fuck. I'm not going to sit here and take this.
Yes, you are, Peter said. You know why? Because if you walk out on me, it's just one more thing you've got to be sorry about. Lacey was halfway out of her chair, but the truth in Peter's words weighted her back down into the seat. He knew her, it seemed, far better than she had ever known him.
Ma,
he said softly, his voice edging over that red line.
I didn't mean that.
She looked up at him, her throat thickening with tears.
I know, Peter. I'm glad you come here. He swallowed. I mean, you're the only one.
Your father.
Peter snorted.
I don't know what he's been telling you, but I haven't seen him since that first time he came.
Lewis wasn't coming to see Peter? That was news to Lacey. Where did he go when he left the house, telling her that he was headed to the jail? She imagined Peter, sitting in his cell every other week, waiting for a visit that didn't come. Lacey forced a smile. She would get upset on her own time, not Peter's, and immediately changed the topic.
For the arraignment, I brought you a nice jacket to wear. Jordan says I don't need it. For the arraignment, I just wear these clothes. I don't need the jacket until the trial.
Peter smiled a little.
I hope you didn't cut the tags off yet. I didn't buy it. It's Joey's interview blazer.
Their eyes met.
Oh, Peter murmured. So that's what you were doing in the attic.
There was silence as they both remembered Joey coming downstairs in the Brooks Brothers blazer Lacey had gotten him at Filene's basement in Boston at deep discount. It had been purchased for college interviews. Joey had been setting them up at the time of the accident.
Do you ever wish it was me who died?
Peter asked,
instead of Joey.
Lacey's heart fell like a stone.
Of course not. But then you'd still have Joey,
Peter said,
and none of this would have happened.
She thought of Janet Eisenhoff, the woman who hadn't wanted her as a midwife. Part of growing up was learning not to be quite that honest, learning when it was better to lie rather than hurt someone with the truth. It was why Lacey came to these visits with a smile stretched like a Halloween mask over her face, when in reality, she wanted to break down sobbing every time she saw Peter being led into the visitation room by a correctional officer. It was why she was talking about camp and stuffed animals, the hallmarks of the son she remembered, instead of discovering who he had become. But Peter had never learned how to say one thing when he meant another. It was one of the reasons he'd been hurt so many times.
It would be a happy ending, Peter said.
Lacey drew in a breath.
Not if you weren't here.
Peter looked at her for a long moment.
You're lying,
he said. Not angry, not accusing, just as if he was stating the facts in a way that she wasn't.
I am not.
You can say it a million times, but that doesn't make it any more true. Peter smiled then, so guileless that Lacey felt it smart like a stripe from a whip.
You might be able to fool Dad, and the cops, and anyone else who'll listen, he said. You just can't fool another liar.
By the time Diana reached the docket board to check which judge was sitting on the Houghton arraignment, Jordan McAfee was already standing there. Diana hated him on principle, because he hadn't ripped two pairs of stockings trying to get them on, because he wasn't having a bad hair day, because he didn't seem to be the least bit ruffled about the fact that half the town of Sterling was on the front steps of the courthouse demanding blood.
"Morning," he said, not even glancing at her.
Diana didn't answer. Instead, her mouth dropped open as she read the name of the judge sitting on the case.
"I think there's a mistake," she said to the clerk.
The clerk glanced over her shoulder at the docket board. "Judge Cormier's sitting this morning."
"On the Houghton case? Are you kidding me?"
The clerk shook her head.
"Nope."
"But her daughter..." Diana snapped her mouth shut, her thoughts reeling. "We need to have a chambers conference with the judge before the arraignment." The moment the clerk was gone, Diana faced Jordan.
"What the hell is Cormier thinking?"
It wasn't often that Jordan got to see Diana Levin sweat, and frankly, it was entertaining. To be honest, Jordan had been just as shocked to see Cormier's name on the docket board as the prosecutor had been, but he wasn't about to tell Diana. Not tipping his hand was the only advantage he had right now, because frankly, his case wasn't worth anything. Diana frowned.
"Didn't you expect her to..."
The clerk reappeared. Jordan got a kick out of Eleanor. She cut him slack in the Superior Courthouse and even laughed at the dumb blonde jokes he saved for her, whereas most clerks had a terminal case of self-importance.
"Her Honor will see you now,"
Eleanor said. As Jordan followed the clerk into chambers, he leaned down and whispered the punchline he'd been getting at before Levin so rudely interrupted his joke with her arrival.
"So her husband looks at the box and says, 'Honey, it's not a puzzle. It's some frosted flakes.'"
Eleanor snickered, and Diana scowled.
"What's that, some kind of code?"
"Yeah, Diana. It's secret defense attorney language for, 'Whatever you do, don't tell the prosecutor what I'm saying.'"
"I wouldn't be surprised," Diana murmured, and then they were in chambers. Judge Cormier was already in her robe, ready to start the arraignment. Her arms were folded. She was leaning against her desk.
"All right, counselors, we have a lot of people in the courtroom waiting. What's the problem?"
Diana glanced at Jordan, but he just raised his eyebrows. If she wanted to poke at the hornet's nest, that was just fine, but he'd be standing far away when it happened. Let Cormier hold a grudge against the prosecution, not the defense.
"Judge," Diana said hesitantly, "it's my understanding that your daughter was in the school at the time of the shooting. In fact, we've interviewed her."
Jordan had to give Cormier credit. She somehow managed to stare Diana down, as if the prosecutor hadn't just presented a valid and disturbing fact, but had said something absolutely ludicrous instead. Like the punchline of a dumb blonde joke, for example.
"I'm quite aware of that," the judge said. "There were 1,000 children in the school at the time of the shooting."
"Of course, Your Honor. I wanted to ask before we got out there in front of everyone whether the court was planning to just handle the arraignment or if you're planning to sit during the whole case."
Jordan looked at Diana, wondering why she was so dead sure that Cormier shouldn't be sitting on this case. What did she know about Josie Cormier that he didn't?
As I said, there were thousands of kids in that school. Some of their parents are police officers, some work here at the Superior Court. One even works in your office, Ms. Levin.
Yes, Your Honor, but that particular attorney isn't handling this case.
The judge stared at her, calm.
Are you calling my daughter as a witness, Ms. Levin?
Diana hesitated.
No, Your Honor.
Well, I've read my daughter's statement, Counselor, and I don't see any reason that we can't proceed.
Jordan ran through what he knew so far. Peter had asked about Josie's welfare. Josie was present during the shooting. Josie's yearbook photo, in the discovery, was the only one that had been marked with the words, "Let live." But according to her mother, whatever she told the police wouldn't affect the case. According to Diana, nothing Josie knew was important enough to make her a witness for the prosecution. He dropped his gaze, his mind replaying these facts over and over like a loop of videotape. One that just didn't make sense.
The former elementary school that was serving as the physical location for Sterling High didn't have a cafeteria. Little kids ate in their classrooms at their desks. But somehow this was considered unhealthy for teenagers, so the library had been turned into a makeshift cafeteria. There were no books or shelves there anymore, but the carpet still had ABCs sprinkled into its weave, and a poster of the Cat in the Hat still hung beside the double doors. Josie no longer sat with her friends in the cafeteria. It just didn't feel right, as if some critical mass were missing, and they were likely to be split apart like an atom under pressure. Instead, she sequestered herself in a corner of the library where there were carpeted risers, where she liked to imagine a teacher reading aloud to her kindergartners. Today, when they'd arrived at school, the television cameras were already waiting. You had to walk through them to get to the front door. They'd dribbled away over the past week. No doubt there was some tragedy somewhere else for these reporters to cover, but returned in full force to report on the arraignment. Josie had wondered how they were going to hightail it from the school all the way north to the courthouse in time. She wondered how many times in the course of her high school career they would come back. On the last day of school? At the anniversary of the shooting? At graduation? She imagined the People magazine article that would be written in a decade about the survivors of the Sterling High massacre. Where are they now? Would John Eberhard be playing hockey again? Or even walking? Would Courtney's parents have moved out of Sterling? Where would Josie be? And Peter? Her mother was the judge at his trial. Even if she didn't talk about it with Josie, legally she couldn't, it was as if Josie didn't know. Josie was caught somewhere between utter relief, knowing her mom would be sitting on the case, and absolute terror. On the one hand, she knew her mother would start piecing together the events of that day, and that meant Josie wouldn't have to talk about it herself. On the other hand, once her mother did start piecing together the events of that day, what else would she figure out? Drew walked into the library, tossing an orange up in the air and catching it repeatedly in his fist. He glanced around at the pods of students, settled in small groups on the carpet with their hot lunch trays balanced on their knees like bows of crickets, and then spotted Josie.
"What's up?"
he asked, sitting down beside her.
"Not much." "Did the jackals get you?"
He was talking about the television reporters.
"I sort of ran past them." "I wish they'd all go fuck themselves," Drew said.
Josie leaned her head against the wall.
"I wish it would all just go back to normal." "Maybe after the trial."
Drew turned to her.
"Is it weird, you know, with your mom and all?"
"We don't talk about it. We don't talk about anything, really."
She picked up her bottled water and took a sip so that Drew wouldn't realize that her hand was shaking.
He's not crazy.
Who?
Peter Houghton. I saw his eyes that day. He knew exactly what the hell he was doing.
Drew, shut up,
Josie sighed.
Well, it's true. Doesn't matter what some hotshot fucking lawyer says to try to get him off the hook.
I think that's something the jury gets to decide, not you.
Jesus Christ, Josie, he said. Of all people, I wouldn't think you'd want to defend him.
I'm not defending him. I'm just telling you how the legal system works.
Well, thanks, Marcia Clark. But somehow you give less of a damn about that when you're the one with a slug being pulled out of your shoulder. Or when your best friend, or your boyfriend, is bleeding to death in front of...
He broke off abruptly as Josie fumbled her bottle of water, soaking herself and Drew.
Sorry,
she said, mopping up the mess with a napkin. Drew sighed.
Me too. I guess I'm a little freaked out with the cameras and everything.
He tore off a piece of the damp napkin and stuck it in his mouth, then tossed the spitball at the back of an overweight boy who carried the tuba in the school marching band.
Oh, my God, Josie thought. Nothing's changed at all.
Drew tore off another piece of napkin and rolled it in his palm.
Stop it,
Josie said.
What?
Drew shrugged.
You're the one who wanted to go back to normal.
There were 4 television cameras in the courtroom. ABC, NBC, CBS, and CNN, plus reporters from Time, Newsweek, The New York Times, The Boston Globe, and the Associated Press. The media had met with Alex last week in chambers so that she could decide who would be represented in the courtroom while the others waited outside on the steps of the courthouse. She was aware of the tiny red lights on the cameras that indicated they were recording, of the scratch of pens on paper as the reporters wrote down her words verbatim. Peter Houghton had become infamous, and as a result of that, Alex would now have her 15 minutes of fame. Maybe 60, Alex thought. It would take her that long to simply read through all the charges.
Mr. Houghton, Alex said. You are charged with, on March 6th, 2007, a count of first-degree murder, contrary to 631-1A, in that you purposely caused the death of another, to wit, Courtney Ignacio. You are charged with, on March 6th, 2007, a count of first-degree murder, contrary to 631-1A, in that you purposely caused the death of another, to wit,
she glanced down at the name.
Matthew Royston.
The words were routine, something Alex could do in her sleep, but she focused on them, on keeping her voice measured and even, on giving weight to the name of each dead child. The gallery was packed full, and Alex could recognize the parents of these students, and some students themselves. One mother, a woman Alex didn't know by sight or name, sat in the front row behind the defense table, clutching an 8x10 photo of a smiling girl. Jordan McAfee sat beside his client, who was wearing an orange jail jumpsuit and shackles, and was doing everything he could to avoid looking at Alex as she read the charges.
You are charged with, on March 6th, 2007, a count of first-degree murder, contrary to 631-1A, in that you purposely caused the death of another, to wit, Justin Friedman. You are charged with, on March 6th, 2007, a count of first-degree murder, contrary to 631-1A, in that you purposely caused the death of another, to wit, Christopher McPhee. You are charged with, on March 6th, 2007, a count of first-degree murder, contrary to 631-1A, in that you purposely caused the death of another, to wit, Grace Murtaugh.
The woman with the photo stood up as Alex was reciting the charges. She leaned over the bar, between Peter Houghton and his attorney, and smacked the photograph down so hard that the glass cracked.
Do you remember her?
the woman cried, her voice raw. Do you remember Grace?
McAfee whipped around. Peter ducked his head, keeping his eyes trained on the table in front of him. Alex had had disruptive people in her courtroom before, but she couldn't remember them stealing her breath away. This mother's pain seemed to take up all the empty space in the gallery, heat the emotions of the other spectators to a boiling point. Her hands began to tremble. She slipped them underneath the bench so that nobody could see.
Ma'am, Alex said, I'm going to have to ask you to sit down.
Did you look her in the face when you shot her, you bastard?
Did you? Alex thought.
Your Honor, McAfee called. Alex's ability to judge this case impartially had already been challenged by the prosecution. While she didn't have to justify her decisions to anyone, she had just told the attorneys that she could easily separate her personal and her professional involvement in this case. She'd thought it would be a matter of seeing Josie not as her daughter, specifically, but as one of hundreds present during the shooting. She hadn't realized that it would actually come down to seeing herself not as a judge, but as another mother.
You can do this, she told herself. Just remember why you're here.
Bailiffs, Alex murmured, and the two beefy courtroom attendants grabbed the woman by the arms to escort her out of the courtroom.
You'll burn in hell,
the woman shouted as the television cameras followed her progress down the aisle. Alex didn't. She kept her eyes on Peter Houghton while his attorney's attention was distracted.
Mr. McAfee, she said.
Yes, Your Honor.
Please ask your client to hold out his hand.
I'm sorry, Judge, but I think there's already been enough prejudicial.
Do it, Counselor.
McAfee nodded at Peter, who lifted his shackled wrists and opened his fists. Winking in Peter's palm was a shard of broken glass from the picture frame. Blanching, the attorney reached for the glass.
Thank you, Your Honor, he muttered.
Anytime.
Alex looked at the gallery and cleared her throat. I trust there will be no more outbursts like that, or I'll be forced to close these proceedings to the public. She continued reading the charges in a courtroom so quiet you could hear hearts break. You could hear hope fluttering to the rafters on the ceiling. You are charged with, on March 6th, 2007, a count of first-degree murder, contrary to 631-1A, in that you purposely caused the death of another, to wit, Madeline Shaw. You are charged with, on March 6th, 2007, a count of first-degree murder, contrary to 631-1A, in that you personally caused the death of another, to wit, Edward McCabe. You are charged with attempted first-degree murder, contrary to 631A and 629-1, in that you did commit an act in furtherance of the offense of first-degree murder, to wit, shooting at Emma Alexis. You are charged with possession of firearms on school grounds, possession of explosive devices, unlawful use of an explosive device, receiving stolen goods, to wit, firearms. By the time Alex had finished, her voice was hoarse.
Mr. McAfee, she said, how does your client plead?
Not guilty to all counts, Your Honor.
A murmur spread virally through the courtroom, something that always happened in the wake of hearing that not guilty plea, and that always seemed ridiculous to Alex. What was the defendant supposed to do? Say he was guilty? Given the nature of the charges, you are not entitled to bail as a matter of law. You are remanded to the custody of the sheriff. Alex dismissed court and headed into chambers. Inside, with the door closed, she paced like an athlete coming off a brutal race. If there was anything she was sure of, it was her ability to judge fairly. But if it had been this hard at the arraignment, how would she function when the prosecution began to actually outline the events of that day?
Eleanor, Alex said, pressing the intercom button for the clerk, clear my schedule for 2 hours.
But you...
Clear it, she snapped. She could still see the faces of those parents in the gallery. What they'd lost was written across their faces, a collective scar. Alex stripped off her robe and headed down the back stairs to the parking lot. Instead of stopping for a cigarette, though, she got into her car. She drove straight to the elementary school and parked in the fire lane. There was one news van still in the teacher's parking lot, and Alex panicked until she realized that the license plates were from New York, that the chance of someone recognizing her without her judicial robes on was unlikely. The only person who had a right to ask Alex to recuse herself was Josie, but Alex knew that ultimately her daughter would understand. It was Alex's first big case in Superior Court. It was modeling healthy behavior for Josie herself to get on with her life again. Alex tried to ignore the last reason she was fighting to stay on this case, the one that pricked like a thorn, like a splinter, rubbing raw no matter which way she came at it. She had a better chance of learning from the prosecution and the defense what her daughter had endured than she ever would from Josie herself. She walked into the main office. "I need to pick up my daughter," Alex said, and the school secretary pushed a clipboard toward her with information to be filled out. "Student," Alex read. "Time out. Reason. Time in." "Josie Cormier," she wrote. 10:45 a.m. Orthodontist. She could feel the secretary's eyes on her. Clearly, the woman wanted to know why Judge Cormier was standing in front of her desk instead of at the courthouse, presiding over the arraignment that they were all waiting to hear about. "If you could just send Josie out to the car," Alex said, and she walked out of the office. Within 5 minutes, Josie opened the passenger door and slid into the seat. "I don't have braces." "I needed to think of an excuse fast," Alex answered. "It was the first one to pop into my head." "So why are you really here?" Alex watched Josie turn up the volume of the vent. "Do I need a reason to have lunch with my daughter? It's like 10:30. Then we're playing hooky." "Whatever," Josie said. Alex pulled away from the curb. Josie was 2 feet away from her, but they might as well have been on different continents. Her daughter stared firmly out the window, watching the world go by. "Is it over?" Josie asked.
"The arraignment? Yes."
"Is that why you came here?" How could Alex describe what it had felt like seeing all of those nameless mothers and fathers in the gallery without a child between them? If you lost your child, could you still even call yourself a parent? What if you'd just been stupid enough to let her slip away? Alex drove to the end of the road that overlooked the river. It was racing, the way it always did in the spring. If you didn't know better, if you were looking at a still photo, you might wish you could take a dip. You wouldn't realize, just by glancing, that the water would rob you of your breath, that you might be swept away.
"I wanted to see you," Alex confessed. "There were people in my courtroom today. People who probably wake up every day now wishing that they'd done this, left in the middle of the day to have lunch with their daughters instead of telling themselves they could do it some other day." She turned to Josie. "Those people, they didn't get to have any other days."
Josie picked at a loose white thread, silent long enough for Alex to start mentally kicking herself. So much for her spontaneous foray into primal motherhood. Alex had been rattled by her own emotions during the arraignment. Instead of telling herself she was being ridiculous, she had acted on them. But this was exactly what happened, wasn't it, when you started to sift through the shifting sands of feelings instead of just feeding facts hand over fist? The hell with putting your heart on your sleeve, it was likely to get ripped off.
"Hooky,"
Josie said quietly.
"Not lunch."
Alex sat back, relieved.
"Whatever," she joked.
She waited until Josie met her gaze. I want to talk to you about the case.
I thought you couldn't.
That's sort of what I wanted to talk about. Even if this was the biggest career opportunity in the world, I'd step down if I believed it was going to make things harder for you. You can still come to me any time and ask me anything you want.
They both pretended, for a moment, that Josie did this on a regular basis, when in fact it had been years since she'd shared anything in confidence with Alex. Josie's glance slanted toward her.
Even about the arraignment?
Even about the arraignment.
What did Peter say in court?
Josie asked.
Nothing. The lawyer does all the talking.
What did he look like?
Alex thought for a moment. She had, upon first seeing Peter in his jail jumpsuit, been amazed at how much he'd grown. Although she had seen him over the years, in the back of the classroom during school events, at the copy store where he and Josie had worked together briefly, even driving down Main Street, she still somehow had expected him to be the same little boy who'd played in kindergarten with Josie. Alex considered his orange scrubs, his rubber flip-flops, his shackles.
He looked like a defendant, she said.
If he's convicted,
Josie asked,
he'll never get out of prison, will he?
Alex felt her heart squeeze. Josie was trying not to show it, but how could she not be afraid that something like this would happen again? Then again, how could Alex, as a judge, make a promise to convict Peter before he'd even been tried? Alex felt herself walking the high wire between personal responsibility and professional ethics, trying her damnedest not to fall.
You don't have to worry about that.
That's not an answer, Josie said.
He'll most likely spend his life there, yes.
If he was in prison, would people be allowed to talk to him?
Suddenly, Alex couldn't follow Josie's line of logic.
Why? Do you want to talk to him?
I don't know.
I can't imagine why you'd want to after.
I used to be his friend, Josie said.
You haven't been Peter's friend in years, Alex answered.
But then the tumblers clicked, and she understood why her daughter, who was seemingly terrified about Peter's potential release from prison, might still want to communicate with him after his conviction. Remorse. Maybe Josie believed that something she'd done, or hadn't, might have brought Peter to the point where he would have gone and shot his way through Sterling High. If Alex didn't understand the concept of a guilty conscience, who would?
Honey, there are people looking out for Peter. People whose job it is to look out for him. You don't have to be the one to do it.
Alex smiled a little.
You just have to look out for yourself, all right?
Josie looked away.
I have a test next period, she said. Can we go back to school now?
Alex drove in silence, because by that time it was too late to make the correction. To tell her daughter that there was someone looking out for her, too. That Josie wasn't in this alone. At 2 in the morning, when Jordan had been bouncing a wailing, sick infant in his arms for 5 straight hours, he turned to Selena. Remind me why we had a child? Selena was sitting at the kitchen table. Well, no, actually she was sprawled across it, her head pillowed in her arms.
Because you wanted to pass along the finely tuned genetic blueprint of my bloodline.
Frankly, I think all we're passing along is some viral crud.
Suddenly, Selena sat up.
Hey,
she whispered.
He's asleep.
Thank God. Get him off me.
Like hell I will. That's the most comfortable he's been all day.
Jordan glowered at her and sank into the chair across from her, his hands still cupped around his sleeping son.
He's not the only one.
Are we talking about your case again? Because to be honest, Jordan, I'm so damn tired that I need clues here if we're going to shift topics.
I just can't figure out why she hasn't recused herself. When the prosecution brought up her daughter, Cormier dismissed it. And more importantly, so did Levin. Selina yawned and stood up.
You're looking a gift horse in the mouth, baby. Cormier's gotta be a better judge for you than Wagner.
But something's rubbing me the wrong way about this.
Selina smiled at him indulgently. Got a little diaper rash, huh?
Even if her kid doesn't remember anything now, that doesn't mean she's not going to. And how is Cormier going to remain impartial, knowing that her daughter's boyfriend was blown away by my client while she stood there watching?
Well, you could make a motion to get her off the case, Selina said. Or you could wait for Diana to do that instead.
Jordan glanced up at her.
If I were you, I'd keep my mouth shut.
He reached out, snagging the sash of her robe so that it unraveled. When do I ever keep my mouth shut?
Selina laughed. There's always a first time, she said.
Each tier in maximum security had 4 cells, 6 feet by 8 feet. Inside the cell was a bunk bed and a toilet. It had taken Peter 3 days to be able to take a dump while the correctional officers were walking past without his bowels seizing up. But, and this was how he knew he was getting used to being here, now he could probably crap on command. At one end of the maximum security catwalk was a small television. Because there was only room for 1 chair in front of the TV, the guy who'd been in the longest got to sit down. Everyone else stood behind him, like hobos in a soup line, to watch. There weren't a lot of programs the inmates could agree upon. Mostly it was MTV, although they always turned on Jerry Springer. Peter figured that was because no matter how much you'd screwed up in your life, you liked knowing that there were people out there even more stupid than you. If anyone on the tier did something wrong, not even Peter, but for example an asshole like Satan Jones, Satan not being his real name, that was Gaylord, but if you mentioned it even in a whisper he'd go for your jugular, who had drawn a caricature of 2 of the COs doing the horizontal hora on the wall of his cell, everyone lost the television privilege for the week. Which left the other end of the catwalk to mosey on down toward a shower with a plastic curtain and the phone where you could call collect for $1 a minute, and every few seconds you'd hear, "This call has originated at the Grafton County Department of Corrections," just in case you had been lucky enough to forget. Peter was doing sit-ups, which he hated. He hated all exercise, really. But the alternative was sitting around and getting soft enough for everyone to think they could pick on you, or going outside during his exercise hour. He went, a couple of times, not to shoot hoops, or to jog, or even make secret deals near the fence for the drugs or cigarettes that got smuggled into jail, but just to be outside and breathing in air that hadn't already been breathed by the other inmates in this place. Unfortunately, from the exercise yard you could see the river. You'd think that was a bonus, but in fact, it was the most awful tease. Sometimes the wind blew so that Peter could even smell it. The soil along the edge, the frigid water, and it nearly broke him to know that he couldn't just walk down there and take off his shoes and socks and wade in, swim, fucking drown himself if he wanted to. After that, he stopped going outdoors at all. Peter finished his 100th sit-up. The irony was that after a month, he was so much stronger that he could probably have kicked Matt Royston's and Drew Gerard's asses simultaneously, and sat down on his bunk with the commissary form. Once a week, you got to go shopping for things like mouthwash and paper, with the prices jacked up ridiculously high. Peter remembered going to St. John one year with his family. In the grocery store, cornflakes cost like $10 because they were such a rare commodity. It wasn't like shampoo was a rare commodity, but in jail,
You were at the mercy of the administration, which meant they could charge $3.25 for a bottle of Pert or $16 for a box fan. Your other alternative was to hope that an inmate who left for the state prison would will you his belongings, but to Peter, that felt a little like being a vulture.
Houghton, a correctional officer said, his heavy boots ringing down the metal catwalk. You've got mail.
Two envelopes zoomed into the cell and slid underneath Peter's bunk. He reached for them, scraping his fingernails against the cement floor. The first letter was from his mother, which he was almost expecting. Peter got mail from his mother at least 3 or 4 times a week. The letters were usually about stupid things like editorials in the local paper or how well her spider plants were doing. He'd thought, for a while, that she was writing in code, something he needed to know, something transcendent and inspirational. But then he started to realize that she was just writing to fill up space. That's when he stopped opening mail from his mother. He didn't feel bad about this, really. The reason his mother wrote to him, Peter knew, wasn't so that he'd read the letters. It was so that she could tell herself she'd written them. He didn't really blame his parents for being clueless. First of all, he'd had plenty of practice with that particular condition. Second, the only people who understood him, really, were the ones who had been at the high school that day, and they weren't exactly jamming his mailbox with missives. Peter tossed his mother's letter onto the floor again and stared at the address on the second envelope. He didn't recognize it. It wasn't from Sterling, or even New Hampshire, for that matter. Elena Batista, he read. Elena, from Ridgewood, New Jersey. He ripped open the envelope and scanned her note.
Peter, I feel like I already know you because I've been following what happened at the high school. I'm in college now, but I think I know what it was like for you, because it was like that for me. In fact, I'm writing my thesis now on the effects of being bullied at school. I know it's presumptuous to think that you'd want to talk to someone like me, but I think if I'd known someone like you when I was in high school, my life would have been different, and maybe it's never too late. Sincerely, Elena Batista.
Peter tapped the ragged envelope against his thigh. Jordan had specifically told him he was to talk to nobody, that is, except his parents and Jordan himself. But his parents were useless, and to be honest, it wasn't like Jordan had been holding up his end of the bargain, which involved being physically present often enough for Peter to get whatever was bugging him off his chest. Besides, she was a college girl. It was kind of cool to think that a college girl wanted to talk to him, and it wasn't like he was going to tell her anything she didn't already know. Peter reached for his commissary form again and checked off the box for a generic greeting card. A trial could be split into halves. What happened the day of the event, which was the prosecution's baby, and everything that led up to it, which was what the defense had to present. To that end, Selena busied herself interviewing everyone who had come in contact with their client during the past 17 years of his life. 2 days after Peter's arraignment in Superior Court, Selena sat down with the principal of Sterling High in his modified elementary school office. Arthur McAllister had a sandy beard and a round belly and teeth that he didn't show when he smiled. He reminded Selena of one of those freaky talking bears that had come onto the market when she was a kid, Teddy Ruxpin, which made it all the more strange when he started answering her questions about anti-bullying policies at the high school.
"It's not tolerated," McAllister said,
although Selena had expected that party line.
"We're completely on top of it."
"So, if a kid comes to you to complain about being picked on, what are the repercussions for the bully?"
"One of the things we've found, Selena, can I call you Selena? Is that if the administration intervenes, it makes it worse for the kid who's being bullied."
He hesitated.
"I know what people are saying about the shooting,
how they're comparing it to Columbine and Paducah and the ones that came before them. But I truly believe that it wasn't bullying, per se, that led Peter to do what he did.
What he allegedly did, Selena automatically corrected. Do you keep records of bullying incidents?
If it escalates and the kids are brought in to me, then yes.
Was anyone ever brought to you for bullying Peter Houghton?
McAllister stood up and pulled a file out of a cabinet. He began to leaf through it, and then stopped at a page. Actually, Peter was brought in to see me twice this year. He was put into detention for fighting in the halls.
Fighting? Selena said. Or fighting back?
When Katie Riccobono had plunged a knife into her husband's chest while he was fast asleep 46 times, Jordan had called upon Dr. King Wah, a forensic psychiatrist who specialized in battered woman syndrome. It was a specific tangent of post-traumatic stress disorder, one that suggested a woman who'd been repeatedly victimized both mentally and physically might so constantly fear for her life that the line between reality and fantasy blurred, to the point where she felt threatened even when the threat was dormant, or in Joe Riccobono's case, as he lay sleeping off a 3-day drinking spree. King had won the case for them. In the years that had passed, he'd become one of the foremost experts on battered woman syndrome and appeared routinely as a witness for the defense all over the country. His fees had skyrocketed. His time now came at a premium. Jordan headed to King's Boston office without an appointment, figuring his charm could get him past whatever secretarial gatekeeper the good doctor employed. But he hadn't counted on a near-retirement-age dragon named Ruth.
"The doctor's booking 6 months out," she said, not even bothering to look up at Jordan.
"But this is a personal call, not a professional one."
"And I care," Ruth said, in a tone that clearly suggested she didn't.
Jordan figured it wouldn't do any good to tell Ruth she was looking lovely today, or to grace her with a dumb blonde joke, or even to play up his successful track record as a defense attorney.
"It's a family emergency," he said.
"Your family is having a psychological emergency," Ruth repeated flatly.
"Our family," Jordan improvised. "I'm Dr. Waugh's brother."
When Ruth just stared at him, Jordan added, "Dr. Waugh's adopted brother." She raised one sharp eyebrow and pressed a button on her phone. A moment later, it rang.
"Doctor," she said, "a man who claims to be your brother is here to see you."
She hung up the receiver.
"He says you can go right in."
Jordan opened the heavy mahogany door to find King eating a sandwich, his feet crossed on top of his desk.
"Jordan McAfee," he said, smiling. "I should have known. So tell me, how's Mom doing?" "How the hell should I know? She always loved you best," Jordan joked, and he came forward to shake King's hand. "Thanks for seeing me." "I had to find out who had enough chutzpah to say he was my brother."
"Chutzpah," Jordan repeated. "You learned that in Chinese school?"
"Yeah, Yiddish came right after Abacus 101.
He gestured for Jordan to take a seat.
"So how's it going?"
"Good," Jordan said. "I mean, maybe not as good as it's going for you. I can't turn on court TV without seeing your face on the screen."
"It's been busy, that's for sure. I've only got 10 minutes, in fact, before my next appointment."
"I know. That's why I took a chance that you'd see me. I want you to evaluate my client."
"Jordan, man, you know I would, but I'm booking nearly 6 months out for trial work."
"This one's different, King. It's multiple murder charges."
"Murders?" King said. "How many husbands did she kill?"
"None. And it's not a she, it's a boy. A kid. He was bullied for years, and then turned around and shot up Sterling High School."
King handed half of his tuna sandwich to Jordan.
All right, little brother, he said. Let's talk over lunch.
Josie glanced from the serviceable gray tile floor to the cinder block walls, from the iron bars that isolated dispatch from the sitting area to the heavy door with its automatic lock. It was kind of like a jail, and she wondered if the policeman inside ever thought about that irony. But then, as soon as the image of jail popped into her head, Josie thought of Peter and began to panic again.
I don't want to be here, she said, turning to her mother. I know. Why does he even want to talk to me again? I already told him I can't remember anything.
They had received the letter in the mail. Detective Ducharme had a few more questions to ask her. To Josie, that meant he must know something now that he hadn't known the first time he questioned her. Her mother had explained that a second interview was just a way of making sure the prosecution had dotted their I's and crossed their T's, that it really didn't mean anything at all, but that she had to go to the station all the same. God forbid Josie be the one to screw up the investigation.
All you have to do is tell him, again, that you don't remember anything, and you'll be all done, her mother said, and she gently put her hand on Josie's knee, which had begun shaking.
What Josie wanted to do was stand up, burst through the double doors of the police station, and start running. She wanted to sprint through the parking lot and across the street, over the middle school playing fields and into the woods that edged the town pond, up the mountains that she could sometimes see from her bedroom window if the leaves had fallen from the trees, until she was as high as she could possibly go. And then maybe she'd just spread her arms and step off the edge of the world. What if this was all a setup? What if Detective Ducharme already knew everything?
Josie, a voice said. Thanks so much for coming down here.
She glanced up to see the detective standing in front of them. Her mother got to her feet. Josie tried. Honestly, she did, but she couldn't find the courage to do it.
Judge, I appreciate you bringing your daughter down here.
Josie's very upset, her mother said. She still can't remember anything about that day.
I need to hear that from Josie herself.
The detective knelt so that he could look into her eyes. He had, Josie realized, nice eyes, a little sad, like a basset hound's. It made her wonder what it would be like to hear all those stories from the wounded and the stunned, if you couldn't help but absorb them by osmosis.
I promise, he said gently, this won't take long.
Josie started to imagine what it would feel like when the door to the conference room closed, how questions could build up like the pressure inside a champagne bottle. She wondered what hurt more. Not remembering what had happened, no matter how hard you tried to will it to the front of your mind, or recalling every last awful moment. Out of the corner of her eye, Josie saw her mother sit back down.
Aren't you coming in with me?
The last time the detective had talked to her, her mother had pulled the same excuse. She was the judge. She couldn't possibly sit in on the police interview. But then they'd had that conversation after the arraignment. Her mother had gone out of her way to let Josie know that acting like a judge on this case would not be mutually exclusive to acting like a mother. Or in other words, Josie had been stupid enough to think that things between them might have started to change. Her mother's mouth opened and closed like a fish out of water.
Did I make you uncomfortable? Josie thought,
the words rising like welts in her mind.
Welcome to the club.
You want a cup of coffee? The detective said, and then he shook his head. Or a Coke? I don't know. Do kids your age drink coffee yet, or am I dangling a vice right in front of you because I'm too stupid to know better?
I like coffee, Josie said.
She avoided her mother's gaze as Detective Ducharme led her into the inner sanctum of the police station. They went into the conference room, and the detective poured her a mug of coffee.
Milk? Sugar?
Sugar, Josie said.